Sanskrit and in women's, Sanskrit and comparative literature from both India and from Canada.
And Oxford.
And she's taught religious studies and women's studies in Canada. And she's got a long list of publications. Her 12th book has just been published. And she's critically edited, is it 2 texts on the Natya Shastra? That's right. And edited three books on the Ramayana. And one of her books Lumbra de Mimesis, the idea of dance in the Sanskrit tradition, which came out
from Kluwer.
Right, Kluwer
in 1991.
And the word My Mother Gave Me, which is a wonderful title, and has that just come out recently?
That came out in 1998.
Yeah. And today she's going to speak to us on images and ideas of the goddess in the Hindu tradition. So I'd like to hand it over to Isabel. Thank you.
Thank you for your kind introduction. As I see, some of my friends are here and some who I'm getting acquainted with. It's a very pleasant experience to be here. And so I think I'll have to perform a little, right? Anyway, this is something that I'm talking about very close to my heart. But because it's of the time and, the subject is very, very, I find it quite problematic and difficult at times. So I have written it down, and I'll read from my writing. And if you have any questions, don't hesitate to ask me, or we could discuss at the very end. We'll go with the flow. In the construction of womanhood in India, the idea of the goddess functions as a philosophical and social archetype that has furnished models of conduct irrespective of caste, social class, and sometimes even religion. Womanhood and femininity have been constructed in the social space, but often also in the metaphysical space, with the figure of the goddess as the common matrix of fabrication. Through time, that figure of mystery, grounded in a profound and complex philosophical imagination, has branched into paradigms of mystical, moral, and social action. As in this list we see, goddess as wielder of power, goddess as mother, goddess as wife, helper or daughter, goddess as seductress. Explicated through legend, iconography and ritual, these paradigms cover a vast range of identities, some mutually contradictory in the moral domain, and they continued to be used to define women and to prescribe their roles in life. As Tracy Pinchman usefully reminds us, it is necessary to examine how structures pertaining to the goddess may help shape conceptions of the female gender, the treatment of women in Hindu society, and the roles that women are assigned. Because of their influence, goddesses are potent and ready sources of images and labels for women in their social relations. In traditional Indian society, the highest respect one can pay a woman is to call her Devi. Barely a step down is to address a woman as mother. I believe this is unique to Indian society, for the rest of the world does not accord this special position to a woman, nor use similarly value-loaded terms. However, whether these terms of exaltation are true indicators of Indian women's actual position in their world is a different matter. It is possible to see this as just another mode of marginalization. For a Devi is by definition written out of common human interactions. Those of you familiar with Satyajit Ray's film Devi, based on a powerful story by Tarashankar Bandyopadhyay, may remember how this process can play out in social reality. But a more intriguing conception of the goddess needs to be noted. In traditional Indian society, even powerful goddesses are seldom imagined, just as mortal women are seldom imagined as single, self-determined persons unattached to a male figure. In Hindu religious thought and practice, particularly in its evolved form, a goddess is always linked to a male figure as his mother or wife or daughter or sister. which suggests that her very identity rests on her relationships with males, with rare exceptions about which I shall speak later. Let me briefly illustrate this statement by looking at the evolution of major goddess figures through Vedic, classical, medieval, and modern times. We can then move on to see to what extent the construction of the goddess has proved to be the paradigm for the construction of women today. To keep the line of evolution clear, I shall look at it chronologically. Who is this goddess? Who created goddesses and how? Does a goddess have an identity of her own? Has she ever been portrayed as an unattached being, an autonomous agent in her own right? Beginning with the Vedic era, we see that a goddess appears in the periphery of the divine world, in which she does not play a central role. The goddess persona was created by the ancient sages as a nurturer, protector, purifier, light giver, or mother. The following are the goddesses who appear in the Vedas: Ushas, or Dawn, most commonly mentioned figure associated with Rita, or cosmic truth, an auspicious being, bringer of light, awakener of all beings, marker of time. Prithibi, the earth, supporting nature, consort of Zeus, nurtures creatures and plants, a mother figure. Aditi, mother of God, of the gods, associated with motherhood, the unbound one, guardian of Rita, the cosmic truth, later identified with Prithibi. Saraswati, a river, represents wealth, vitality, nourishment, and immortality. Fecundity, she's associated with the sacrificial goddesses Ida, Bharati, Mahi, and Hotra, identified with purity, inspiration, eloquence, learning, art, music, and she is wedded to Brahma. Vach, she represents sound and speech, a powerful being who controls ritual order, a mother figure, creator of three Vedas. She is associated with Prajapati, represents Shabda Brahman and Sphota. In addition, the Vedas mention less benign goddess figures, including the following: Niriti, later identified with Alakshmi, the dark aspect of the Vedic vision of the divine feminine, associated with decay, need, anger, cowardice, old age, and death. She appears in the 10th mandala. Ratri, or night, her positive qualities are as provider of comfort and security and bringer of sleep. She is the sister of Ushas and a powerful mother figure. Her negative aspects are barrenness and gloom. Minor Vedic goddesses include Purandhi, Parendi, Raka, Dhishana, Sinibali, Ida, Bharati, Mahi, Hotra, Surya, Danu, Saranyu, Sarama, Aranyani, Rudrani, Varunani, Agnai, Shachi, or Indrani. As a quick summing up of the Vedic goddesses, I will mention that A. None of them rivals male gods. They are all in the periphery. B. Some of them survive into the later classical period but change substantially, sometimes several goddesses being merged into one. C. New goddesses appear. And D. There is no great goddess in the Vedic tradition. In the classical age, the concept of the goddess came into greater prominence. New goddesses began to appear, often leading to synthesis with older goddesses. It is interesting to see how they were imagined at that time. Take, for instance, Lakshmi, idealized as the perfect wife and yet characterized by shifting attachments to different male figures, with Vishnu as her sixth and final consort. Parvati is a Patibrata, as illustrated in the story of Sati. Durga is the epitome of power and energy, but derived from the chief gods. Saraswati continues to be a purifier who is occasionally attached to gods. though not always very successful. Kali appears as an unattached force to begin with, who is a perplexing figure with a terrifying potential for annihilating creation. Among other goddesses from this period are Chinnamasta, Tara, Dhumavati, Bagala, and others, who are related to tantric practices and have been represented from the beginning as terrifying figures and have remained on the periphery of religious lives. Two other female divinities to appear at this time were Sita and Radha, who began as mortal incarnations of Lakshmi. Sita, to begin with, was viewed more as the perfect wife, the exemplary Pativrata, but in time her virtue invested her with divinity. Radha's apotheosis is more problematic because she does not fit into the common pattern of goddesses and is valorized on the basis both of bhakti or devotion and prapatti or total surrender. In general, we see through this period the rise of goddess worship as a distinct part of Hindu religious life, in particular the worship of Durga as the mother goddess who nurtures and protects the universe and destroys its enemies. Most of these goddesses have emerged from Puranic and epic tales. The particular identities of these evolved figures are worth a closer look. Shri or Lakshmi. Shri has been known since pre-Buddhist times and later came to be identified with Lakshmi, in which form she has been worshipped by all castes. Her origin may lie in pre-Vedic Indo-European traditions, although she does not appear in Vedic literature till the late Vedic era. As the term Shri implies, this goddess has many auspicious characteristics and functions as the provider of food, the upholder of regal power and noble rank, the bringer of jyoti or sacred illumination, of prosperity, fortune, beauty, and health. The term Shri, which occurs frequently in later Vedic literature, refers to the power to rule and dominate subjects, but is related more to the office of the ruler than to the ruler himself. And as such, she may be attached to anybody who deserves her. Thus, Shri is positioned in early Hindu theogony impersonally, and for a long period moves from one deserving consort to another, moving from Soma, Dharma, the two dharmic demons Bali and Prahlad, then Indra, and finally Vishnu. In some legends, she is also attached to Kubera, but it is Vishnu, with whom she has resided permanently as a model spouse since the 4th century of the Common Era. Obediently serving her husband as her lord and losing her mobility, she incarnates herself as a helpmeet to Vishnu when he assumes his avatara forms on earth. In that relationship, she exemplifies orderliness in human relations and society, thus providing a model for human emulation. Shri is exalted beyond that model in the Pancharatra school of thought, which views her as the supreme object of meditation and worship, in whom are united the cosmic functions of the three gods, Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva. For the Sri Vaishnava school, she is the intermediary between Vishnu and his devotees. Just for your visual pleasure, let me put it that way, I have used some nice paintings and sculptures. I made some overhead papers to project, but I think this, you can see, this is Lakshmi or Shri seated on a lotus, and this comes from a 17th century painting where she is usually she is associated with lotus. She is out of this world, she is transcendent. The next goddess I'm going to talk about, I'll give you another pleasure for your eyes. I'll be talking about Parvati and then Saraswati. Parvati has no independent identity, but is defined exclusively by her relationship to Shiva. She first appears as a reincarnation of Sati, the first wife of Shiva, who dies of grief at his humiliation, and thereby causes Shiva to launch a cycle of destruction to avenge her death. It is to dissuade him and to bring him back from his life of renunciation to a worldly one that Parvati was born. She is the role model for a Hindu woman in her dedication as a maiden, wife, and later as mother, a model housewife. She is identified with the creative power, Prakriti. In the southern school, she is taken as Shiva's embodied grace. Sati and Parvati does not appear in the Vedic literature directly, but develops from Rudrani, the consort of Rudra, later evolved as Shiva. In Kena Upanishad, we find Uma Haimavati, the daughter of Himavat, who is later identified with Parvati, also the daughter of Himavat. Her role is one of channeling the unbounded energy of Shiva, potentially a destructive force, into the conservation of creation by containing him within the domestic acts of marriage and procreation. This role emphasizes her wifely functions and devotions, and devotion as well as the physical beauty whereby she lures the ascetic Shiva into a domestic and thus manageable life. This emphasis on the union between Shiva and Parvati also facilitates the philosophical pairing of Purusha and Prakriti, which is a highly complex issue that we shall have to leave aside today. Otherwise, I don't think I'll be able to manage. We may bring it up later. And I think Professor Rukmani will be very good in participating if we get into that kind of discussion, if we have time. Saraswati is the only goddess from Vedic times who has retained her importance from that era to this day. She began as a river with the power of cleansing impurity and of bringing fertility. She is associated with speech, poetry, music, culture, and learning, who brings wisdom and enlightenment, but also possesses healing powers as a divine physician. Unlike other goddesses, she never acts as an intermediary, for she is an independent goddess who constantly breaks out of occasional linkages with other divine beings. In those linkages, however, she is cast in roles controlled by male figures. For instance, she is thought to be the daughter of Brahma or his wife. She is also imagined as one of Krishna's five Shaktis, as well as co-wife of Vishnu with Lakshmi. In Hindu thought, Saraswati loses the early association with the river and is equated with Vaj or speech. In that identity, she is exalted as Shabda Brahman and as mantra itself. Her sovereignty over wisdom, learning the arts and music makes her a form of cosmic Shakti. We come to, this is Saraswati from a Jain carving of 17th century, and this is from 18th century. Parvati is domesticated portrayal with Ganesha on her lap. This is Durga. In this portrayal, she has more than 10 hands, but we are more familiar with seeing her with 10 hands. And here we find another portrayal of her killing Mahishasura, for which she was born, she was imagined, she was created. Not only Mahishasura, she killed many more, but this is the way most of the times we find her during the Durga Puja festival, her portrayal. This is the most common and popular, particularly in the eastern region of India, Bengal in particular. Durga, as a warrior goddess, she protects creation from evil. She is the most powerful female figure in the post-Vedic Hindu pantheon. Her birth occurs during a cosmic crisis when creation is threatened by a demon, and she arises out of the combined shaktis of the major gods with the express purpose of slaying demons. I'd ask you to note this, that she is created from the god's powers. She becomes Shiva's wife and reigns over a family that is idealized as the model of domesticity. Although she is a loving and nurturing mother, she is also a fierce and independent being who needs no help from male gods and acts alone, but sometimes creates other goddesses out of her own shakti, which she has acquired previously. She also defeats those who aspire to dominate her by creating illusions, which earns her the title of Mahamaya. Devi Mahatmya identifies her with Shakti, Maya, and Prakriti, and relates how, after she killed Mahishasura, the gods offered her stuti in the verses Ya Devi Sarvabhuteshu Shakti Rupena Samstita Namastasyai 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 Namo Namaha. And it has become part of the ritual of Durga Puja in Bengal, particularly. There are sets of verses, but I have picked up 21 verses, which is a part of stuti from the gods. These 21 verses after Mahishasura's batha, they portray and praise goddess, mostly of abstractions, identified her with abstract principles, but in three verses they have identified her with mother figure, with a wifely figure, and when even they have identified with Maya, she is connected with Vishnu. So whenever any anthropomorphic connection is made, there is a male relationship. So Ya Devi Sarvabhuteshu Vishnu Mayeti Shabdita Namastasyai 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 Namo Namaha. And in the entire set of verses, she is identified with Chetana, Buddhi, Nidra, Kshudha, Chaya, Shakti, Trishna, Shanti, Jati, Lajja, Shanti, Shraddha, Kanti, Vritti, Smriti, Daya, Tushti, and Bhranti. These are all abstract principles, but she was also equated or identified with Lakshmi, Rupena, Samstita, Matri, Rupena, Samstita, and Vishnu, Mayeti, Shabdita. We come to Kali. Just, you know, we'll discuss these things. I just wanted you to be aware of this. The relationship with male is always emphasized. Kali is another difficult figure, but I'll try to sort of address her. Kali is the embodied rage of Durga and her alter ego. She is presented in this two that I have be able to bring here. This is also part of, I'm sorry, this is here. Here is one where Brahma, Vishnu, Shiva is giving her their power and also adoring her. And this is a more modern rendition of Kali. This is how she is often painted and worshipped. Kali is the embodied rage of Durga and her alter ego. Kali is seen when we encounter Parvati's story. Parvati becomes Kali when she is enraged. She takes a bath, one part of her becomes black, the alter ego, and the other remains Gauri. So these stories just come up all the time in the Puranic tales. The earliest references to Kali are medieval, occurring around 6th century of the Common Era. She is often placed in the periphery of Hindu society or on the battlefield. In later times, Kali is shown as Shiva's wife, but her relationship with him is entirely contrary to that with the other goddesses we have considered so far. Instead of calming him and containing his destructive potential, Kali incites Shiva in his uncontrolled rage, and they feed one another's destructive instincts. One narrative tells of them dancing so wildly that their motion brings creation to the edge of dissolution. In most accounts, it is Shiva who has to contain Kali's lust for destruction. In later times, two traditions develop in Hinduism, one being Tantrism and the other devotional Shakta tradition of Bengal. In the first, Kali represents the ultimate divinity upon whom the devotee meditates in order to gain release and salvation. In the Bengali Shakta tradition, the devotee assumes the position of a helpless child who surrenders totally to Kali, as the loving mother who will reward the devotee with liberation. We come to Mahadevi, another imagination or portrayal of Devi. She is known as a powerful, creative, active and transcendent female being. All other goddesses, including Parvati, Durga and Lakshmi, are understood to be aspects of this Mahadevi or Devi. In many texts, she is described as a supreme and unmatched ruler of the world and its root. She is the mother of all, the life force in all beings and the sole cause of the universe. According to Devi Bhagavata Purana, she is the creator of Brahma, Vishnu and Shiva and commands them to carry out their cosmic tasks. Four central philosophical ideas underlie the concept of Mahadevi, namely Shakti, Prakriti, Maya and Brahman. She is portrayed in mythology as a distant, awe-inspiring figure, but one who is always responsive to the plea of her devotees. Matrika. The Matrikas, or the mothers, comprise an extremely important group of goddesses who are clearly understood not to be divine consorts or shaktis of male deities, but are extensions or forms of Devi herself. There are sometimes 7 or 8 or 10 Matrikas that appear in various texts. They are primarily an independent group of goddesses possessing a violent nature and are associated with diseases, particularly those affecting children. Matrikas appear in various Puranas, the best known account appearing in Devi Mahatmya. The Mahavidyas. They are a distinct category comprising 10 goddesses, namely Kali, Tara, Chinnamasta, Bhuvaneshwari, Bagala, Dhumavati, Kamala, Shorashi, Matangi and Bhairabi. They were born out of Sati's anger at being denied an invitation to her father Daksha's yajna because of his contempt for her husband Shiva. Accepting Kamala and Shorashi, who express the eternally youthful energy of Devi, the Mahavidyas are fearsome beings who represent her violent and destructive aspects. You realize I have given you a succinct kind of description of all these gods and goddesses, goddesses, because you know one can write a book on each one of them, so we don't have time for that, so just a succinct description of them. Then we come to two different kinds of goddesses, Sita and Radha. Sita is perhaps the most popular heroine of Hindu mythology. She started as a mortal being, right? As Rama's ever devoted wife, she is the role model for Hindu women who remains uncomplainingly loyal to her husband despite suffering injustice at his hand. A goddess named Sita appears in Vedic literature as a fertility figure, which is consistent with the meaning of the term Sita or Pharaoh. But she has no connection, this Sita of the Vedic literature has no connection with later figure of Sita. Although in the Valmiki Ramayana, our Sita is identified as an incarnation of Lakshmi, her deification is a later development that occurred through regional versions of the Ramayana. She was not a significant figure prior to the Ramayana, but afterwards assumed importance. Radha, initially a mortal heroine, is in an adulterous relationship that paradoxically elevates her to divinity because the object of her love is Krishna, which makes her a symbol of humanity's total, unconditional, and selfless surrender to the divine. The Radha-Krishna love story begins as a human romance, but in the Puranic era, that story develops into an allegory of the human-divine relationship. This reveals Radha as the complement to Krishna, and thereby invests her with divinity. In early legends, she has little importance as merely one of the gopis, but in the later Puranas, such as Brahmavaivarta Purana, she is viewed as an aspect of Devi, more specifically as Krishna's Shakti, and at one point she becomes identified with Lakshmi. She serves as an exemplar of absolute surrender to God without any thought of self-interest. Her portrayal is of self-abnegating love, whereas Sita's is a self-centered one. Why I say that? Sita loved and followed Rama as her duty, social obligation, whereas Radha did not care for social boundaries, social restrictions. I'll elaborate on that later. Then we also cannot ignore village goddesses. They are important in village life. The villages of India, in which the majority of India's population still reside, tend to have their own resident divinities, of which most are goddesses. Manasa, Olabibi, Mariamman, Shitala, so on. They protect villages from mishaps and ensure timely rain, good crops, and well-being. Village goddesses are usually not represented by anthropomorphic images, but as uncarved stones, trees, or small shrines that do not contain images. They are seldom associated with a male deity. These village goddesses are thought to predate the founding of their respective villages or to have actually founded their villages, which are usually considered to be the consort of the goddesses in place of male divinities. This survey, I hope you could get some ideas of the goddesses that I'm talking about. And it should be obvious from the survey I've just offered that Hindu goddesses fall into two broad categories of identity, as indeed has been observed by others. Professor Flood has remarked in his introduction to Hinduism that there are two kinds of goddess representations, a ferocious form, such as Kali, and a gentle, benevolent form, such as Tripura Sundari or Lakshmi. David Kinsley differs from many students of Hinduism in denying that Hindu divinities are forms of a fundamentally unified conception of the Godhead, but accepts that Hindu goddesses fall into two broad categories, one characterized by the maternal instinct, the other not. The implications of this division for women's lives and society's expectations from them are enormous. For, as I said in my opening remarks, it is from the perceived identities of goddesses that models of conduct for women are drawn. At the same time, the process may be seen also in reverse, in as much as socially desirable characteristics of women are imputed to goddesses and thus valorized, which in turn enforces the assumption of such traits by mortal women. I'll just go over this before I... This is one of the Mahavidyas, Tara. This comes from Nepal. And this one is a Gujarat, comes from Gujarat. Again, another, Parvati, the ideal mother with Ganesha. And I talked about Radha and Sita. This is from Kalighat painting in the 19th century. And this is very, very modern, a couple of years ago. A patua from Medinipur or this painters of scrolls who sing about Ramayana story and other stories in their painted scrolls. You see, she has been deified, Radha. And Sita has much more implications about her social situation. And here you see all the four brothers are pointing her that you should go through this fire ordeal. And she is pointing at them that you have put me in this kind of situation. So this is the tale that I hear from these scroll painters who sing around the month of Magh or Chaitra, January or March, in the festivals, village festivals, and they tell their own stories. It's a very living kind of story that affect every woman, man's life. Anyhow, I go back to the benevolent goddesses. The type of goddess marked by benevolence has given rise to the most influential models for women, all designed to inspire devotion to domestic functions. From women's self-preparation for marriage, to loyalty to the husband, to nurturing children and conserving the family's well-being, Parvati is the exemplar of unrelenting efforts to become a suitable bride. The legend of Lakshmi provides the pattern of the wholly devoted wife. Also, a convenient model for arranged marriage system. You see, Lakshmi is given to Vishnu for the sixth time, and she does not protest, she just stays on. So it's arranged that way. And Parvati, in her previous incarnation or birth as Sati, strives to get to Shiva. And this is a continued theme that we find when we discuss next week Antal's poems, that this kind of practice is still very much there, or in Bengal Shivaratri Vrata, less common among well-educated or middle-class people, but it's still very much in practice that younger girls are encouraged to do this kind of vow to acquire, as Sati did, Shiva or Vishnu in the south. We'll get into that maybe in our discussion. The legend of Lakshmi provides the pattern of the wholly devoted wife. Durga is revered as the protector of her children, and though her wrath is not exactly enjoined upon the earthly mother, it is implicit in the expectation that a mother must go to all lengths to save her children from harm. The translation of these goddesses into human role models shows the requirements of social order very well indeed, especially in the weakening of emphasis on the power of inherent in the great goddess persona of Durga. Given the paramount importance of the roles of wife and mother for Hindu women that Samyukta Gupta speaks of in an essay, it will not do to draw too much attention to the goddess as a transcendental force. Hence, it is the loving aspect of these goddesses that is emphasized, and their roles as wives and mothers that is held up for imitation. This focus on familial roles also explains the popularity of Sita, who, as the idealized wife born as a mortal but with her true identity in divinity, bridges the divine and the human, softening the element of power in the Devi persona into the tenderness of the wife. Before I move on to the other category of fierce and destructive goddess, let me note that between the two polar identities, there is an area in which alternative models for women may be generated. Indeed, this seems to me a particularly sophisticated aspect of Hindu thought on femininity. For it acknowledges that there is a part of female nature which resists conventional social roles without subverting them. This acknowledgement centers on Saraswati, the one goddess who refuses to be bound to the service of male figures. As a female being without husband or children, Saraswati pursues an independent existence on a plane elevated from mundane family life or common social relations. Thus, for the rare mortal female who renounces ordinary worldly life or is forced to forego its pleasures and demands, Saraswati is a viable model within the order of conventional society. Radha, on the other hand, is a problematic one. Her portrayal remains problematic to a group of devotees who finds it difficult to come to terms with an adulterous relationship. The Ballava Sampradaya, for instance, portrays her as Krishna's wife in order to justify their relationship. Vaishnavas mainly see themselves as the males, they are female, see themselves as Radha in relationship to Krishna, as Chaitanya does. To many Vaishnavas, her love is explained as the ultimate selfless love because she ignores social boundaries. For others, she stands as a metaphor of human passion for the divine. Sita, on the other hand, fits in perfectly well as an uncomplaining wife whose sole purpose is to follow her husband's every wish and to put his intense interests above her own. Sorry, my eyes. Now I come to the ferocious representation. The ferocious beings imagined as deities of destruction, necessary as such destruction may be, are obviously not models for women. How then may they be relevant to the Hindu idea of womanhood? Before considering this, I must remind you that Kali or even the still more fearsome Chinnamasta or Chamunda are not uniformly and entirely dealers in death and destruction, but also benevolent and munificent to their devotees. Even in their rage, they can be stopped by sincere supplicants. Besides, their rage is in fact a response to the need for protecting their supplicants. That is why, on considering Kali's history in the Hindu imagination, it is impossible to miss a deep anxiety, for she is at once essential to the survival of the universe and a threat to it. The response to this anxiety is twofold. She is either pushed to the periphery of social space by being lodged in cremation grounds and uninhibited wastelands as the presiding deity of wild tribes and robbers, or she is domesticated as the devotee's mother or even as a child. In this latter idiom, she is depicted as a ferocious yet beautiful young woman with eyes that promise kripa. While in the former mode, she is a fearsome, demonic figure with a disfigured, often skeletal body. It is in this image of Kali that we find the characteristic predicament of patriarchal systems in dealing with female ownership of power, while acknowledging the need for that power. Tracy Pinchman observes that in the Brahmanical tradition, there is a strong tendency to portray Prakriti, Shakti and Maya on one level as positive and creative, yet at the same time inherently ambiguous and potentially dangerous. Therefore, they must be monitored and controlled so that they manifest their positive tendencies rather than their negative ones. Where the goddess is as fearsomely powerful as Kali, the way to assert control is either to keep the possessor of the power on the margins of the system, or to keep her power in check by confining her within familial relationships. Obviously, Kali cannot be the source of any workable model for women within the order of power relationships of conventional society, which finds it more beneficial to press women into roles of service and submission derived from divine females. But that is precisely why in our own world, where questioning conventional order is viewed as a necessary task, particularly for women, Kali has been drafted as the exemplar of a liberating energy implicit in women's nature. At the same time, the conformist impulse in social life is no less a part of our reality, which demands unambiguous guidelines, driving up the pressure, at least among present-day Hindus, to conserve the models of conduct for women derived from the religious foundations of their lives. I find it a pleasing irony that those who battle conformity should borrow strength from a goddess, which proves that these ancient constructions of the imagination still command modernity. Thank you. I thought you would like this painting as well. As I said, Saraswati is a difficult but nice god for us. Here we see one more. Saraswati and Lakshmi, two sisters. Mm. Some kind of family relationship is always needed. It's a Kalighat painting.
And when one is there, the other will not be there. Where there is learning, there is no wealth, and where there is wealth, there is
no wealth. We all can feel that. But, during Durga Puja, she is with her mother, both of them with her mother.
This is the dilemma of modern universities.
Yes, it is, yes.
Learning is considered as wealth, and it is a privilege.
I have some slides I could show you, or, if you have enough of visual food, then I will just...
Are you happy to take questions?
Yeah, I'm happy to take questions, absolutely.
Good, we need that.
Thank you so much.
Perhaps if I could begin, it's interesting, this vast wealth of representations of the goddess that you've shown us today. I was wondering to what extent you think it relates, these different kinds of representations relate to different kinds of social levels and social classes, if they do at all. I was just reminded, I was in Kerala once with a friend of mine, Rich Freeman, who was an anthropologist, and we were looking at these Tayam goddesses, these ferocious goddesses, who manifest in these dancers, these male dancers. And we asked this old lady if this Bhagavati in this village here was the same one as a Bhagavati who had the same name, Chuliya Bhagavati, in a village 3 miles away. And she was puzzled by the question and said, no, this one's here and that one's over there. So sort of immediately kind of subverting that whole sort of discourse of they're all manifestations of the one great goddess. So I'm wondering if...
You are right, and that's a dilemma we all confront. But, in the North, I have encountered this, and I think Professor Klostermeyer has referred to that. If you ask even a simple villager, Bhagavan Ekai, God is one. It's very common.
It could be, yes.
Yeah, so that could be, it's
Kerala-specific.
Kerala-specific or, certain village areas. And in their area, goddess behaves like this. Mm. In the another area, she is like that, depending on the need of the village. Mm. She looks after the village. Mm. That's what I find. And that's why when I studied Manasa in detail, that's another area I have studied at length, with Manasa Mangal and others. Manasa is still in the periphery. Even though she is the daughter of Shiva, and there you find Chandi, is no longer like good Devi Durga. She is full of wrath, she is full of envy, jealousy. She blinds Manasa in one eye. This is no goddess that we are familiar with. And so this is this question of that Ramanuja presents with little tradition and greater tradition. When they try to sort of take them into the greater tradition, then there is some kind of give and take. And as you said, of course, in Kerala or in other villages also, this kind of ordinary women, ordinary uneducated women, they see it at different, but at lower level you just keep on pushing them. So you mean goddess and gods are different in different places, but at the back of their most of their mind they will say Bhagavan Ek Hai, God is one.
But that is, you know, the same thing they call it Teyam, which, and of course it's a corruption of Devam. But at the same time, it's more localized. You don't find it so... It's so much in North Malabar, and that's, I'm sure you... So that's precisely what... Related to that is my question as well. Because there are these, not only the ferocious and the benevolent, but there are also this parallel folk as well as... you could call it Vedic, non-Vedic, folk, little or great,
whatever name.
And also regional, because when you talk about Radha, for instance, I have two comments, one on Radha and one on Sita. Radha is not a pan-Indian figure, because the moment you cross the Vindhyas, because Radha is worshipped, as you very rightly said, in the east of India, particularly in Bengal and Orissa and,
also in Mathura, Vrindavan.
Yes, Mathura, Vrindavan. But when you cross the Vindhyas, immediately because of this adulterous relationship, she's just wiped out completely, and that's why you find Rukma Bai. She's replaced by even Vithala. It's Rukma Bai. Rukmini takes over, and the entire south will not consider Radha at all.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that one, maybe one should be a little sensitive to, because this is a wonderful survey you have given us. But at the same time, there are these minor local variations. And the other thing was in Valmiki Ramayana, as you very well know, that Sita does not normally, I mean, she doesn't obey Rama completely at all times. I'm sure you are very familiar with that. The way she protests, and I mean, Rama wants her to stay back, and so does Kausalya and the whole lot of them, but she stands up as a very independent woman, and she argues and argues, and of course gives very valid arguments, and then of course she goes to the forest. So in this kind of dichotomy, as well as a kind of bringing together, very fascinating.
It is. I'm glad that you brought this to up, because I thought, you know, if I talk more than 50 minutes, that people will just lose it. But these should be discussed, and you are absolutely right. The story of Radha started as, you know, just one gopi. Insignificant.
And she's not even there in the it's a favorite gopi in the Bhagavata.
Yeah, she's just one of them.
Exactly.
But by the time, the culmination was reached in the Gita Govinda period, right? 12th century. And then in Chandidas Vidyapati in Bengal, Brahma Vaivartana Purana, she starts. But the culmination is Gita Govinda. Yes. But after Gita Govinda was written, there were 40 such stories or, you know, verse, poems were written following him. Jayadeva, because it left so much impact. Yet, as you said, in the south, that impact was lost because this adulterous relationship was absolutely a no-no. And that's why what was done with Krishna of the earlier age, he's in Mathura and Vrindavan. Radha's love is metaphor for human-divine relationship. But people were not all that much happy. So Krishna was taken to Dwaraka, where he lives a real domestic life with Rukmini, and, you know, married there. He has two wives, right?
Yes, Satyabhama
and Rukmini. So that was all right with Orthodox group. But continually, there is a kind of uneasiness over this Radha's relationship. In the east, yeah, Chaitanya you find, and he identifies himself with Radha, And when I talk next week, I'll elaborate on that. The Mirabai, when she wants to see Jiva Goswami, he refuses to see a woman. And there, Mirabai sees everyone else as a female. Only Krishna is the only male. So that sort of thing goes on, as you said, dichotomy, contradiction. And I think that enriches the Hindu thoughts. There is always this you find, and there is no one kind of statement you can ever make.
But also the origin of Radha itself. You see the word Radha, because the first reference, as you find, is 3rd century BC in Gatha Saptashati.
Right.
It's the Prakrit work.
Yeah.
So you see, from there, how did it enter here? How did it get? I mean, it's a fascinating thing.
As you said, you know, this whole process of pan-Indian tradition versus regional tradition, which I find fascinating even when I look at the Nritya Shastras, Shastras on drama and dance. This kind of conflict, this kind of rejection of local tradition is always there, not only in religious lives, in also cultural life, this rejection of regional tradition, and there is such tension between the two. Eventually, some things are taken from here and there, and then we have a larger picture. Even Durga had some tribal connection, Vindhyavasini, and so on.
That's very interesting about Radha being not accepted in the south and more accepted in the north. Why is that? Is that because, I was wondering if it's something to do with cross-cousin marriage practiced in the south and not on the north? Just thinking of my feet, I don't know.
You can comment on this.
I would give you a parallel example from Valmiki's Ramayana. When Kamban translates the Valmiki's Ramayana, Kamba Ramayana in the 9th century, see, as far as Valmiki is concerned, Ravana drags Sita by the hand and takes her to, when he goes by his Pushpa, whatever Vimana. But when it comes to the south, now Kamban, the regional, they are very particular. Even the brother will not touch the sister, the husband will not, touch the wife in public. You know, they're very, very particular about this physical contact. So you find Kamban makes Sita walk behind Ravana.
Absolutely.
So they're very sensitive. Like, for instance, today when they do the Terukutu, the Mahabharata plays, you will be very familiar with those things. The moment, because Draupadi has married, it's a polyandrous relationship with the five. So the moment she comes, immediately they'll do a lot of puja and all that, because there is something wrong there. The south is very particular about these things. So it's a cultural thing. I wouldn't really relate it to the
Go back to Sita thing when you started, because in Valmiki we do find Sita has a voice.
Yes.
She not only says tells Rama, what are you talking about, I must go with you, I must follow you. And at the end, when she goes through this Agni Pariksha, she really tells her mind off, that how can you say, exactly, ask me to do this. Who changes it? Tulasi. No one else. Tulasi changes Sita to be a meek person. And that's what I find in the UK, in North America. Sita's stories has been written by Jacqueline Southernhurst, and that becomes a kind of must story given to younger women. This is how you should follow your husband. And I'll tell a small anecdote. I used to teach, or still teach, women and religion, goddess, and all sorts of things. So I asked my students to read the Ramayana, abbreviated version, of course, and come back next week with a question: did Rama treat Sita well, or was this injustice? Two students did not appear for 3 weeks, and they came after 3 weeks with tears, because one girl of Indian origin, born and brought up in Canada, she went back to her grandmother, and grandmother and mother said, I'm teaching the wrong thing. You cannot ask Rama the God, any question. And the other girl was a Muslim girl, born and brought up in Canada, but came from India originally. And her mother said that this is wrong teaching. She gave her daughter, when she was growing up, Amar Chitra Katha, and asked her to be like Sita. It doesn't matter which religion, Sita is the ideal wife. Mm. So I told them that when you come to an academic exercise, the questioning should be there. I'm not asking you to not revere Rama. He can be your lord, but you must ask questions. So this is the problem that has happened because of Tulsi's Ramayana. Mm-hmm. The rest of India, there are 300 Ramayanas at least, mm-hmm. right? In the south, correct me if I'm wrong, in the south, more problem with caste system. You see the questioning of Shambhukabadha and all those things. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the eastern belt, the question, the voice that Sita was given, I have written many essays on that, articles on that particularly. Sita is absolutely, the way she's talking to Rama, you can't imagine, from Krittivasa to Jagadrami Ramayana, that do you call Rama an educated person? How can you behave like this? And those are the words put in Sita's mouth. So it's not an unquestioning Sita that we find all over India. So that's something. So I'm working on the Bengali Ramayana. There are 30 of them. So hopefully at some point I'll have something more to say.
I was thinking on this point perhaps also, I'm thinking about rather South India and this epic, which I guess because it's also in the tale of an anklet, I can't recall the name.
What did you say?
I guess more epic, the tale of an anklet.
Oh, Shilapadikaram.
And so, again, it seems to me, I don't know if it was written for that purpose, probably not, but it seems to counteract a little bit this sort of movement where we have goddesses setting, standards for women in general. And in that epic, we find something totally different, which is kind of like the antinomian behavior is kind of upheld, And I find that quite interesting because the woman is then kind of asked to find her divinity, her goddesshood, and she endeavors to do that. So it's kind of like, I think, quite in contradistinction with all these instances that you've given, it seems to me there's also this aspect, and also in Kashmiri Shaiva tradition as well, we find very much the opposite direction, a different movement which seems to
but you
take place.
Use the word goddess, she becomes goddess, so there is a role model there, right? Or is it, from goddess it goes to
yes.
the woman and the mortal woman also, so it's a kind of complementary.
Yeah, but she's not asked to remain, within that. She's not asked to remain a woman, and her status is not a woman as a permanent.
Becomes a goddess.
Yes.
Yeah. So that's
her destiny in certain sense.
So that's another marginalization. She's not equal. She's another kind of marginalization. Either goddess or seductress. You have these two polar opposites. That's the problem. A woman is not not an equal in a patriarchal society. Either you have to be goddess
or a woman
who seduces, lures, and all sorts of things. You find in Buddhist literature so much in Therigatha. It's just or in earlier.
Well, perhaps it's more obvious in the Kashmir Shaiva tradition, but it's more abstract, of course, with the ambivalence of Shiva.
But then even there you have Sarika, the mother goddess, and this most Jagrata Devi there.
Yes.
Yeah, but you are right. Kashmiri Shaivism is more of an abstract thought, but on that kind of thing, I think she is the person who can comment more. But anyway,
I'm thinking when you were referring to Durga and her emanation from the concerted efforts or imagination of the gods together. It seems to be some sort of paradox because it depends on which angle you're looking at it from, but if the gods themselves are activated through this prakriti and they need it to combat a real demon in their world, you kind of have this overlapping of imagination and reality that keeps folding upon itself.
Yeah.
Can you, elaborate or
Well, this is what we find, that goddess, you know, that's the paradox that I have difficulty to come to terms with, because Durga has power, but who lends her the power? She's not a Swayambhu. She is, you know, created from power of male gods. They can't do it alone, so they put together all the powers and created this.
And also the question would be, where did they come from? Where does their power derive from? I mean, is it ontological, or are they themselves activated by Prakriti? And that's why I think...
That's where we get into trouble. Right?
No, but there's a philosophical dimension to this. The moment you get into power, energy, that's the kind of ontological explanation. Because one cannot... That's precisely why you have Kashmir Shaivism also, where Vimarsha... You see, all these are female deities, if you want to call them, because they're female genders. Shakti is everything. So in a certain sense, there is a kind of an implicit ontological acceptance that energy, without energy, there cannot be, you know, further whatever. And so to that extent, yes. But otherwise, you know, as you very rightly said, even when Kashmir Shaivism, when Shiva, you realize Shiva, you are not realizing Shakti. Mm. You see, everybody becomes Shiva. Again, it's a male deity. So are we then... So these are questions which can be philosophically explained, but I don't think that would really come within.
Yeah, that is a difficult... Yeah. You are a very... Well, that question is very justified. Yeah. But I am not at a loss, yeah, just as you are. How do we come to terms with that, you know? And Purusha and Prakriti, these two... ideas, but they feed each other. Without Prakriti, Shiva is Shava. I don't know if anybody else can comment on that. In my little power, I just did that. And I just wanted to show you two more pictures. You know, this is the modern rendition of Saraswati and Lakshmi. I don't like them. I like those older things. And this is the ideal.
Yes.
Shiva, Durga, and you see, a woman must not be taller than the shoulder length. And this is not typically Indian. I was reading an Italian painter's manual. And the instructions are there that a woman should be painted not higher than the shoulder length, of a male body. And you don't have to follow any kind of measurement to draw a female. You just draw it. But for a male, you have to be very particular, follow all the rules. Anyway.
And I thought Shilparatna doesn't have Shilpa Shastras.
Shilpa Shastras, they do. But they do mention that women should be smaller.
Yes. But the measurement
is there.
The proportions.
Shilpa Shastras, Shilpa Prakashas. I'll bring those up next week. But this is another picture, somebody painting, actually dancing, you know,
yes,
who she
yes,
is. my niece. And she is doing, preparing herself as Radha to meet Krishna.
When did this come into vogue, the Saraswati?
I think
it's very common nowadays.
It's calendar art.
Okay.
It's no high class painting. Oh, okay. But you find it everywhere, which really pains me. This is also modern. I mean, 19th century. It actually, you were right, from Ravi Verma. The influence is from Ravi Verma. You are absolutely right. This kind of, but Ravi Verma was gifted. They are not. If anything else that I must apologize that in this 1 hour or less than 1 hour, I tried to sort of put them in a little bundle. I hope
we can carry on for another 15.
If you have any more questions, you can. And I was hoping that
if not, maybe we could see the slides, because I think the illustrations also are wonderful.
Okay, shall we? Mm.
Can you see them again? You may need to come at a different angle.
Yeah, but... Okay, this is... I forgot all about it. I forgot all about it. This is, from Mohenjo-daro area, pre-Vedic. And the mother figure comes out like this. I thought, whether a mother figure worshipped in this way, we don't know. As we all know, Indus Valley civilization is a big puzzle for all of us. We don't know anything about it, except for these artifacts. Okay, this is Shiva holding on Sati's body when she died out of grief. And remember, I think is a very, very important point that I wanted to make, is that everybody says, follow Sati, this whole question of Sati, which has come back in 87, Rup Kanwar's immolation of wives after the husband dies. This is a wrong kind of interpretation to my mind, because nobody talks about Shiva's love for Sati here, only Sati's total dedication. He went mad with Sati's body, he carried all around, and Vishnu had to intervene and cut into 51 pieces, and there are 51 pithas or pilgrimage sites, and this is a beautiful rendition around 12th century. This is very unusual from the south, actually. Durga, Saraswati, or is it from Nepal? I forgot.
It looks more like from Nepal.
Saraswati, Lakshmi, the entire family. Okay. Kartikeya and Ganesha here. Okay. Ganesha and Mahishasura. And Shiva on top. You cannot worship Durga, although she comes with her family. But you have to worship Shiva and put him on top. Another Mahishasura Mardini. This is from Mahabalipuram or Mahamallapuram. I think this is a beautiful one. Yet another. Devi.
Where's this from?
This is also south.
Was she holding there? Hopefully sometimes.
Oh God, how does one go back? I'm terrible. And this is usual. Do you want to try?
You go through the whole thing and then come back one to the
Shall we?
It's the trouble with it. The oldest time projectors were actually much more flexible.
We couldn't go back. So, usually in Durga's hand, Mahishasura Mardini or Shumbhani Shumbha, Madhukaitabha. So every time, mostly we find the death of Mahishasura is depicted. Here she has only four hands, right? This is also from the south. More and more these pictures are in with all those weapons given to her by different gods. There is a beautiful one in Chidambaram. This is
like Nepal.
And this is Chamunda.
Chamunda.
Chamunda. Chamunda. That's what it says. Chandi, no. But this is the one that I wanted to.
No, we passed it.
No, I will go back to all of them. All right? This is the one that I really like. All the gods are gathered together to create Durga. From Brahma to Shiva, Vishnu, and all the others, whoever had whatever power, they all gave to create Durga. This
from
is beautiful. This is Rajasthan.
And you don't know the date.
I could look it up. Because when they are there, I can't... And this you have seen.
Yes.
I have some of those. This I also showed. We have a book here in at the center called Devi, and they, most of them are here. And these are these, you know, Mahavidyas and either Dhumavati or, you know, one of them, the Tantric goddess. This is
Radha?
No, 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 no. This is Kamala. Sri.
Oh, Sri. Okay.
I don't know. I have to check. And this is, you know, one of these struggle with Devi creating all these Mahavidyas in her battle against the demons. The Punjab Hill paintings have created, you know,
the miniatures.
Miniatures. This is a miniature. This is also a similar hard struggle or battle with various demons and help from, you know, this is God. This, I thought, is a much more calming thing. With the third eye and perhaps Trinayani Durga, with two eyes, like any other goddess or mortal beings, and the third eye on her forehead, which is the divine eye with which she can see beyond human perception. This is another kalpana or imagery or idea of God and goddess as the same, as the one, male, female, Purusha Prakriti. And I think Rukmani would be a much better person to comment on that. God as one, no male, female, half is male, half is female, Ardhanarishvara. This comes more often than not in the idea of gods and goddesses, in the discussion of them, particularly when we look at the philosophical texts. Am I correct, Rukmani? And this is with Shiva, Shakti, more common, but also with Radha and Krishna. In painting also you will find this idea. This we have seen. These are the matrikas. Here they are painted so beautifully. It's on top of a manuscript. You know, eight matrikas. They are usually a bringer of disease, and they are worshipped to get, you know, people worship them, try to appease them. Please don't inflict on our children. These are eight matrikas here.
Radha's not there, is she? The boar-headed one, she's not there.
No, I have some pictures where there are seven, there are eight. So these legends differ, as you said, from one place to another.
And they're always malevolent?
They are malevolent.
Always, eh?
That's how I find them. This is our Saraswati, who is very favorite. It should be very favorite of all of us, right? Oh.
Same thing.
Oh, it went back. See? Now we can go back.
Oh, beautiful. The Sita, Agni Pravesha.
Sita, this is... Look at her. So she did not really enjoy it, did she? And in one of the Bengali versions of the Ramayana, we find that Agni Dev is returning after showing her, finding her totally pure. He's returning her to Rama and commenting, Dekhilam eito karjo. Jedin habe Ram Rajyo diner proti ei ki bichar habe. That means, look, this is what I find in Rama's doing, Rama's action. When he holds the kingdom, is this how he is going to look or treat his subjects?
And that is why tradition is so ashamed of this. So the Adhyatma Ramayana changes it into Shadow Sita.
Yeah. And Uttar Charit will have that. So people are so uncomfortable with the whole thing. And that's why Rama has not been treated in Bengal all that well. There is no Ram Mandir in Bengal.
And people are scared to give the name Sita.
Yeah, we do not name our daughters ever Sita.
They're unhappy.
Unhappy.
Eternal unhappy figure.
That is true, you know, even...
Sita is an unusual. You do find, like, even Radha is also very uncomfortable.
This is a striking painting.
Very, very beautiful.
Very beautiful. I will have to look at
18th century.
Yes. Yeah, right. And this is the ideal womanhood, right? Mother with a child.
But that's always true, right?
Well, so this is, you know, kind of a woman, mortal woman, imposing it on goddess, or goddess imposing it.
This is
kind of.
And this is universal, I guess.
Yeah.
Mother and child.
No? But that's where they should be. That's the problem. And this is this following Saraswati. So I thought I'll just. This is from
Khajuraho,
Odisha,
right? Yes.
Is it Odisha?
Odisha.
Konarak. Khajuraho is also similar.
This is Konarak, perhaps. Mm-hmm.
And I thought
she's writing.
Yes, so there were women who were writing. You know, that we find in Kavya.
But they were
Shakuntala writing.
Shakuntala, yes.
Okay.
Damayanti wrote a letter and sent it.
In the Kavya, it can't handle this. Thingy.
To the focus cut?
Focus. Anyway, this is the you know, modern way of worshipping goddess with her family, entire family in Bengal.
This is the only time Shiva doesn't accompany.
But she's has to be on top. He is there.
Yeah, behind
you. And this is how the puja is done today. And at the end of the puja, you know, married women exchange sindoor.
Yeah.
And they ask her to come back again next year and that sort of thing.
But you know, in the south, they have what is known as the nine nights, the Navaratri.
Yeah, Navaratri.
It's only women. The boys and the men are kept out. And they'll decorate the whole thing with a lot of steps, a lot of, you know, decorative articles. And only girls will be invited. They will sit down and sing. And then they will be distributed sweets. The men are kept out completely for nine nights.
But is that because they are crying for a husband?
No. It's just Durga Puja and Saraswati, Lakshmi and Durga.
But yeah, I'll answer to that. Mm. I see beyond that, as you see, that yes, women, like when they do the vratas, the vows, women do it. They are in charge. Everything, they are in charge. Mm. But this is something a woman should do.
Mm-hmm.
Who dictates that? The society, right? And this is good if you do that. And the whole attitude of the society, it's now ingrained in every woman's life as well. Mm-hmm. So when they do the vratas, the vows, these kind of, as you said, nine-day festival, they prepare. They always did that, even in Vedic times. Mm-hmm. The Jajniyas, the Somyag, women are providers for, you know, all the paraphernalia for a Jajniya. But the actual performance is done by a man.
In the matriarchal society, for instance, I would take a different take, because there is importance to women. In a matriarchal society, for instance, it isn't as if they are preparing, because these are young little girls, you know. Mm-hmm. They haven't even reached the age of puberty or anything. They are not. They can also. Others also are invited. I don't think there's an agenda there to prepare for a good husband or anything.
Maybe it's not good husband, but this is the family values that they are taking on. But you might say that for men also that sort of thing is there. But the burden is usually on women's shoulder, right?
Even this 21st century.
No, I have no problem. Right now, I can handle them. This is another.
This is the modern one, right?
The modern one, but the whole decoration is with pith. You know, it's a very. It's called shola, a bark of a particular tree, soaked for 3 months, and they come out like, you know, ivory. And then very, very delicate.
And most of them are Muslim artisans who make these.
Yes,
right.
Mostly, yes.
But this, which again shows the integrity.
You know, the picture that I showed of Sita, it's a very unusual group of painters in Midnapur, near Midnapur. They call themselves Chitrakar Jati.
Mm.
And their husband, if the husband has a Hindu name, the wife has a Muslim name. Gulab Chitrakar, and this painting was done by his wife, Noor Jahan. They do not eat with the Hindus, nor do they eat with the Muslims. They call themselves Chitrakar Jati. They are neither Muslims nor Hindus.
And there's a temple in south where Nachiyar, you know, their first worship, Ramanuja mentions this, the first worship at, I forget the place, you have to first worship this Muslim lady before you go into the temple itself. She's right at the doorstep because she was one of the, you know, devotees of Vishnu. Mm-hmm.
Plus when Vrindavan, I know the dresses that are sewn for the deities.
Yes, exactly.
By Muslims, they're experts.
Well, it is the apolitical agenda that creates all sorts of problems. Anyway.
Oh, yeah. Oh, this is nice.
This is Jagannathri, actually.
But it's a modern one, right?
Oh, these are all modern. I just...
Actually, it's chronological what you're doing. Actually,
yeah,
this is
these
also
are all
pit.
Modern. Mm-hmm. Pit, yeah. This is Kali. Mm-hmm. And for a Bengali, I think Kali is not all that fearful. And, you know, for a Bengali, there is another explanation. Kali looks so terrible because she has taken on all the evil of the world so that you are spared. She has taken it onto her body. And, you know, nobody talks about when Vishwarup Darshan occurs. Krishna looked terrible, didn't he? With, you know, eating all those human or, you know, creatures. And that has never been emphasized because Kali also, when she's Durga, she's Devi or in any other form, or in a form in which she's worshipped in various places in Bengal, she looks like a young woman, very beautiful. Not black, but bluish tinge, usually. So it's an ambivalent. I'm not, you know, making it. This is Lakshmi, a modern rendition, mm-hmm. with her owl, the wise owl, at her feet. This is our Saraswati. In Bengal, I don't find quite very often she carries a rosary. So that kind of thing is absent. But sometimes you do find if she has four hands. But she's often depicted more kind of anthropomorphic human figure.
This is, you said?
Saraswati.
But I was wondering about the swan there. So.
Swan is always with Saraswati.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Sometimes
yeah,
in the north, they have peacock.
Yeah. Exactly.
They have peacock. In the south so also.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But our
Bengal, that's why
Bengal is... Bengal, and not only Bengal, Assam, Orissa, Bihar, this whole belt you'll find. I don't know about Andhra. But we always have swan, because swan is also connected with Prajapati Brahma.
Yes.
And she has some connection there.
And also learning.
Learning.
Nirakshira Vivekitu.
Nirakshira. And also this purity, the whole idea of purity is there. So there endeth my discussion.
Beautiful.
Next week it will be poetry. I tell you I'm not going to talk about this. But if you have questions, you are free. And if you have any question, feel free. I'm here almost every day.
Well, thanks so much, Dr. It's a wonderful and showing us these fascinating slides.
I think there's one more.